Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
Justin Robert Young.
Hi, friends.
The dream is alive!
Wait a minute, what are you all fired up about?
Gentlemen, I'm beside myself. I watched a video this week which was amazing.
Well, I don't see what... Wait, this wasn't the SpaceX crew eject thing, was it?
That was amazing, too.
Oh, but not the amazing thing you're talking about.
This is like every childhood fantasy I had before puberty come true.
Oh, so it's not Game of Thrones then.
That's amazing. This is unexpected. This was a gift out of the blue. Like, all of a sudden, hey, this is a thing now. This is a real thing. Brian, I sent you a video clip, and I put the appropriate music towards it, which for audio listeners won't mean anything except as you guys describe your visceral excitement as you see this.
Okay, here we go. So I'm going to, let me real quick, I'll mute the appropriate channel.
I am like, I don't know why there aren't press conferences. I don't know why, you know, you're just telling us about the tragic situation going on in Austin with the flooding and stuff like that.
Sure.
And we talk about it. If only.
All right, here we go.
Oh, God damn. You got the right music? The music for the right side?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, I can't hear it.
Oh, right. Yeah. Dude, we're hearing, this is I Need a Hero, right?
I can't hear it, but that's okay. So, what this is, tell us what we're looking at, Brian.
Dude, we are looking at a real-ass dude on a real-ass hoverboard, real-ass floating over a lake. I believe he set a Guinness World Record for the world's longest hoverboard flight. Is that right?
Yes, this is, understand folks, this is not some 3 millimeter off the ground on some little copper plate that's about as exciting as standing on a cookie sheet with butter on the bottom that people have been excited about. No, this guy's 10 feet up in the air, standing like the friggin' Green Goblin, flying down a lake, okay? And, you know...
It's legit, dude. And it's like you look at it and he's out over a lake, I assume for safety reasons, if nothing else, because let me stop listening to we're gonna have to listen now to the hero it. Song. There we go. So farthest journey by hoverboard, Guinness World Records. So he's over a lake. And you see, for a split second, you can squint your eyes and think that you're watching a dude wakeboarding. Is how casual it looks.
Yeah, he's standing on a little floating platform. All of a sudden, it takes off. There's a spray. We don't get a close-up of what this thing is, but I assume it looks like it's about, you know, about, looks like maybe 6 really powerful quadcopters.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, so this is a fan board?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, he's hovering, so let's call a spade a spade. It's a hoverboard.
It's a hoverboard.
The dude is just riding a majestic array of drones, basically.
And it's not huge. This thing is probably maybe 6 feet across, but it's not like, you know, he's standing on some, you look at him and it looks like just a dude standing on a thick snowboard.
Yeah, like a double size wakeboard, or maybe 2.5 times what you picture a traditional snowboard or wakeboard looks like.
So I guess there, I mean, and that's the big question, is whether or not this, so he's over a lake, but the lake is playing no part in his movement, right?
No.
Other than, so when he falls, he has something to fall into. It is
sure.
It
yeah,
is.
Yeah, yeah. But that, I guess that's why he's doing it. It's not like the water is part of the flight.
No, 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 no. He says he can go, quote, scary high with this thing.
Well, I believe it. Right? You could just fly. But yeah. Now here's the amazing part is that so much of the control factor is, I'm sure you know, you have a very cheap, very fast, very efficient microcomputers controlling each of the fans in order to keep things relatively balanced. in what, 5 more years, we're going to be at a place where you couldn't fall off of this if you tried to. We're going to be in a place where you could try to screw it all up, and it would, and the device would be smart enough to make sure that you stay balanced, regardless of whether or not you're even conscious. It could probably flip you upside down and gently take you down to Earth if you pass out.
I think yes. I think the answer to that is yes. I think I think we're heading towards kind of a drone bubble. There's so many different companies making drones right now that there's just never going to be as much demand for what they're offering right now that you have to start diversifying this technology into other things. You know, like package delivery, but what this guy's built here is, you know, it looks like from what we see, I think maybe 8, you know, it's hard to get any really good close-up footage of it. It looks like he's got about 8 quadcopters there, or 8 units there. And so it's one guy built this. Imagine if Elon Musk got a little inspired.
Well, and here, let me go to full screen. Let's see if we can take it up to HD. Let's do our own Weird Things investigation.
Oh, well, and also here's the big thing. Or the one thing that is absent here that was also absent that other hoverboard, which I agree with you, Andrew, is far less impressive than this, is also the sound to it, right? Like, because this is an audio-less video, unless what? There is audio that we're not playing.
No. Yeah, there is audio here. Let me.
Yeah, it's loud. I mean, it's like 8, you know, quadcopters.
We're able to hear it here, but for some reason Skype doesn't want to receive back one of the audio channels. Here's what it sounds like. So you can hear the moment that this fires up. So I mean, it sounds.
But you want to know what? Like, that's really that probably makes less of a commotion than, you know, those like water jetpack things, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I would imagine it sounds about
personal,
like
personal and interesting.
It's a different pitch, but it sounds like a, you know, dual outboard engine. Yeah. For the audio listeners, just this is the sound of all three of us being transfixed at the future right in front of us.
Yeah. So imagine it's a dude in kind of a lake appropriate bodysuit with you know, his feet are in 2 kind of like snowboarding boots. And below, yeah, just imagine that you have fused together like 8 quadcopters.
Okay, so here's the question is, are we seeing the beginning of, like, I mean, this is a thing that can be done, and that's the biggest gap, is going from 0 to anything, and now we are at anything.
Record was 164 feet. This was 1,000 or 900 feet.
Okay, well, and it's very clear watching this that this guy could have gone 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times as long. I don't know if it's a battery issue.
Battery.
Yeah. What are we going to do about the battery issue? Do you think we're going to move to... So what are the solutions? You got... you could switch to hydrogen, you know, fuel cell everything. We create, you know, whatever. Let's say for sake of discussion that either solar becomes insanely cheap or... what do you call it? You know, fusion, cheap fusion becomes possible or whatever. Let's say that the electricity is free and we can generate hydrogen all we want. Good idea or bad idea to solve everything with little, you know, instead of CO2 cartridges, you got hydrogen packs.
No, too many containment issues. I think there will be applications for hydrogen, but I don't think it's really a practical solution for most things. And battery technology, there is a lot of exciting stuff on the workbench. You know, getting it from there into devices takes a lot longer. And every few months we get exciting new battery development that, yeah, MIT researchers were able to get into work in one situation, but not scaling. But every now and then something does move forward on that. We're getting batteries are getting better. We're improving them. There are supercapacitors and other technologies there. I think most of the future is going to be battery powered. That's why Elon Musk, who's probably one of the smartest people in the world, is building his gigantic gigafactory.
What about liquid metal batteries? Do you think it's all highfalutin, high end? Eventually, all cars will run on atomic power hype, or do you think it's practical and around the corner?
I think that we only need. You know, we only need our next generation battery to really have an effective solution for cars, because, I mean, you're already getting a Tesla has a 200 plus mile range. You know, if your next iteration of battery triples that or whatever, you're looking at over 1,000 mile range for one of these cars, which is pretty damn good. So, you know, I think that's going to be.
I guess is the simultaneously sexiest and unsexiest answer that we are on the right track. We know what the technology is, and it's just a matter of it continuing to iterate and improve.
Or the technology is out there. We don't know which one will be the one that'll win the Game of Thrones, but we know that there are a lot of people on it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? Is here's what's exciting is part of the reason, you know, if for anyone who hesitates to understand why evolution works, evolution is an extremely crude, very slow way to iterate forward. However, it is unfathomably, unimaginably diversified. It's massive parallel computing in on the greatest scale. It's like, let's try random crap and see what works. It goes up. And through all of, you know, since the birth of man till now, we have not been highly diversified. We have not had a lot of parallel computing. There's been a very small elite privileged group of white Europeans, you know, in the last 200 years who have been able to have the resources to advance things. But all of that is out the window now. Now everything's democratized. Now somebody right now, I got an email today or a tweet today from somebody saying, holy cow, I'm so thrilled I found you on Twitter. I bet I'm the only Kurd who is watching the premiere of your show on the other side of the world. And like all of a sudden, what to me was a might as well have been a fictional land on the other side of the planet that I heard in news stories, all of a sudden became very real. And you realize that guy, you know, it turns out that guy wanted to learn magic from a jackass on the other side of the planet. But someone else in that position wants to make the ultimate liquid metal or battery or whatever. And it's like, I don't know. I think we talked about this before, but it's astonishing how slow it took to just get the data to start churning to get those innovations. And it's not slow. It all happens instantaneously. And now you can order DNA kits at home and start making your own revolutionary breakthroughs.
There's, I think, the next biggest leap, and we talked about this last year, was there's a technology which is now being put out and tested in San Francisco. It's by the company called Artemist, by a guy named Steve Perlman, who's been a developer of other technologies. And that is the idea of basically creating micro little cell spots no bigger than your phone, essentially, so it can send tremendous amounts of data, huge, huge, huge amounts of data, works with interference, all of this stuff. Uses what they call beam shaping, et cetera. So the idea is that you could stack, you know, 10 phones on top of each other, and each one could be getting a separate 4K signal with no interference.
Wow.
In the patent filings for this technology, it was noted that this same thing could be used for the transmission of wireless power.
Now, okay, every time I've heard this, I don't know if you've turned on the internet lately, but did you hear that Tesla had a magical power beaming free electricity tower that the whole world was going to have free power or whatever? It's like that nonsense is so over the top that it actually cools me off on even listening to a legitimate claim like this one.
But the problem is, here's the thing. Perlman ain't the one saying this. Perlman has not been out there saying, hey, we can transmit. And we understand we do have forms of commercial induction, whatever, now that work, you know, from certain phones, things like that, work a small distance up. There is commercial applications.
Well, I mean,
that,
that's on the Apple Watch. That's what you use, right?
And, yeah, and you have and other ones that are like, here. Yeah. But when it gets just you're going different distances, the problem is the efficiencies aren't there, a drop off, whatever. But Perlman has not come out and said, hey, everybody, not only can we do this, we can also transmit power. That's the funny thing is he's not said that, but people have been digging through the patents, look at it, go, wait, this technology would really do well by that too. And that says to me more than anything else, the fact that they're not out there just saying, hey, we've got this new thing. But they have, like, you can go to CES now and stuff and they have demos. There are technologies now that have extended beyond the laboratory. And remember, the Tesla thing was not going to be an efficient thing. I mean, you're right, basically ionizing the air and everything like that. And, you know, it was not going to be, wouldn't have been fun to be around.
Yes. Well, and also it's like the drop off was ridiculous. I mean, it's a highly inefficient way. I mean, you could, I don't even know if you can get effective light from it. But then again, I'm not smart.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, there are things that we think are easy problems to realize. They're much more complicated problems. And there are things that we realize are, you know, we can sort of just rule out. But then it comes down to, well, maybe there is something to it. And so I think that, you know, I'm not saying this is going to be next year. And I'm not saying it's even 10 years out. But I am saying at some point, I do think that we will solve this issue.
Dude, I'll tell you what, it's past performance is not an indicator of future performance, but if we can interpret anything from the, you know, mankind's track record, is that whatever progress we make this year will be beat by the progress we make the year after, and the year after that, and the year after that, and the year after that.
Mm-hmm. So, hoverboards, guys.
So that's, I mean, all right, here's my question. What we saw just now, in 10 years, is something like that, or that idea of using the quadcopter stuff as a hover implement, more or less in use than the Segway?
Oh, more. The Segway.
I mean, because the Segway, for as laughable as the revolutionary human mover technology, is something that I see, you know, probably once a week between tourist stuff in San Francisco or random cops in airports and stuff like that. Like, Segways are around. They are a thing. Will people be riding these? Either not to say that for the same use, but just in terms of different kinds of people moving technology.
Well, I mean, like that thing, I think it's a hard one to answer, because if I'd my friends, I'd be like, no, but if I go to Mount Hood or if I go down to the river, then yes, you know, I'll see them everywhere. They're very different applications. They're very, very different. You know, I don't know that they're going to be street legal for flying down the streets with power lines and stuff and utility poles and stuff because of people.
Well, to put it in perspective, the Segway was first shown by Dean Kamen in 2001. So that's what, 14 years ago. So the question is, 14 years from now, I think that would be the fairest comparison.
So then what, Andrew? What would you say is a better comp? Like, what is a better a thing that'd be interesting to measure it against?
What was the comparison for a helicopter before we had a helicopter?
I mean,
plane.
A plane or a hot air balloon, or, you know, it's like or a
dirigible.
Dirigible, yeah.
But I mean, those were. But I mean, none of those. It ended up filling niches and applications that none of those were used for, essentially.
Oh no, I would say that the helicopter definitely has taken over, because it used to be that if you needed to, let's say, there's a forest fire and you needed to dump water on it or whatever, that's the kind of thing you would throw a Zeppelin at and it would slowly get over there and do it. And now you don't.
Did anybody ever do that?
I don't know, but I'm saying, like, if that problem existed and that absent that technology, that's something you could do with cruder versions in the same space.
I guess the problem is we keep looking at the past as a blueprint for the future, but bigger, shinier, and more expensive. And I'm trying to say that, no, it might be a totally different thing than the thing where is it sport, that, you know, where people, the way people use sport motorbikes, you know, but maybe not so much on road. It would be cool. Maybe, you know, we're going to get, you know, I do think that this indicates to me that now that people see that this drone technology can carry somebody and it looks really damn fun, mm-hmm. that you're going to get a lot more people going, yeah, how can we use this for personal transportation? How can we do this? And
I mean,
we
yeah,
are.
I guess I don't mean to say that any of these things are this other thing or that this will follow in the footsteps of it. Just, you know, like even if we are going to say, you know, in terms of we saw a dude do it on the river, right? And that looks really fun. If we're going to compare it to, like, you know, jet skis or four wheel motorcycles or something like that, like, you know, Where do we think that we might see something like this in the future, I guess?
Take the same technology here, put a chair, a reclining kind of chair in there, surround those rotocopters around there like that, have better battery technology that goes more than 1,000 feet and gives, or 1,000, you know, distance, that gives you, you know, 30 minutes or 40 minutes or an hour or whatever, and that might be much further out. You have a really awesome form of personal transportation. Combine it with all the technologies they're developing for self-driving cars. We've now got, besides Google and Tesla, and Apple secretly spending gazillions of dollars on self-driving cars. You also have Uber doing this now. Transportation is becoming a very, very exciting area of technology, and we're looking for that big leapfrog, that big fundamental change that's not just – it's not just a car. It's the way it works and the way we think about it. And I look at this stuff and I think like, oh, if I can move a if I can take a person from point A to point B, you know, with needing an area smaller than a parking space to land something, you know, do you?
Well, I mean, my only hesitation to get excited about that is because structurally, you've described nothing that's not already available in the kind of homemade gyrocopter that mailman built. And
oh, you couldn't land in a parking space. In a gyrocopter takeoff, remember, it has to have runway.
Okay, well, or a helicopter. I mean, okay, never mind. Forget it.
How is this functionally different than the helicopter that pops out of Inspector Gadget's hat?
Well, I think that, you know, helicopters have become very awesome, very useful pieces of technology that most larger cities can afford to buy them. You have news agencies have these sort of things. And now you see a push towards using drones for stuff where traditionally you would send a helicopter out there. Now you can do a drone because it's cheaper. This isn't you, but you don't land a helicopter in the middle of a city street or even on a highway in most situations.
I personally think the noise issue means that you never see this in cities. You see them banned in cities. It's the kind of thing that you could use, you know, like
I don't know, man. Like I used to live on a in an apartment next to two highways that interchanged, and the motor, like if we're into like banning things because of noise, like motorcycles are the worst, and I can't imagine it being louder than motorcycles can get.
Two things. First of all, the noise is something that everyone can point to. They're like, do you want that around your city at all times? Then everyone will say no. Second of all, the biggest thing is that it won't be fly-by-wire or whatever. This is the kind of thing that you can have out in the country. You're like, well, if I was going to drive over, I'd have to go a mile down this road. I have to go 3 miles down this road, blah, 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 blah. He's literally, you know, this parcel of land is literally 500 yards away as the crow flies. Why don't I just fly like a crow? And so I could see something out there, kind of like the sky equivalent of a four wheeler. I could see, but that's certainly you're looking. I don't see it in cities at all.
Well, that was, you know, Elon Musk's biggest criticism of the electric car, of the flying cars. He said we could build one now, but the big thing is that it's. The noise issue is one, is how loud they would be, and then the amount of wind that it puts up. This device is much more, but when you say, forget cars, we just want to move a body from point A to point B, it becomes a different challenge than trying to move 2,000 pounds of steel and carbon fiber. The other thing, too, is drone noise suppression is a very big active area of research right now, because as drones become popular, because they're an accessible technology you can work on a college workbench in an engineering school, there's a lot of effort being put into now, how do we make them quiet? Because you look at them and go, man, this is amazing. This is the future. Been here. We're like, well, that part sucks.
Yeah.
How do we eliminate that? And that's a problem.
And you know, I'll bet you that there were people, you know, 30, 40 years ago who would be blown away by how quiet we've been able to make computers with fans, you know, and stuff like that.
I mean, as somebody who used computers 30 years ago, they're actually, I mean, they got slightly louder, but it's like, you know, there were no fans in the Apple IIe's. There were no fans in, you know, there were small fans in some of the early 286s. The peak of fan noise really was the late 90s, and then liquid cooling came in, and all of a sudden fan noises weren't a problem again. So it's like,
well, I guess I'm not thinking personal computing. I'm thinking more like, you know, the larger, big, like, room computers and how, you know, loud and stuff, you know, that they just the idea of like how quiet machines could be, you know, I feel like we're constantly making them quieter and quieter and less obtrusive. That's just kind of the march forward on it.
Yeah, I guess my hesitation to think that we're going to see a lot of advancement in making things quiet is that from everything, like the highest important and where the most money and the most talent to throw at the problem would be to making, you know, helicopters silent. And you know, we've had helicopters, what, 60, 80 years now, Andrew? And it's like, and they still, yeah. Oh, go ahead.
But no, but that's been that's actually that was part of the secret military tech that got exposed when we went to try to, you know, whatever the situation was behind getting a, you know, Bin Laden was, you know, we have ducted helicopters and things that are a lot more quiet. They've been able to reduce the noise on those things considerably.
Yeah, I wish we. I guess we're in crazy speculation mode. Once we get past that. Speaking of which, you mentioned Uber working on self-driving cars. Man. I for some reason, I don't know why I never bothered to look at the Austin subreddit before, but since it's been raining here again and there's flooding and stuff, and you know the big question is like how far until we undo the drought. The first thing I saw was fascinating to me that that there are PSAs being run in the local newspapers that have subtexts of "Don't get murdered, skip Uber," basically. It's paid for by the local cab companies. This PSA that appeared in the Austin Chronicle says stranger danger equals Uber. Don't get into cars with strangers. Get into cars with our other strangers. But it's like, how long until we start seeing PSAs like this that say, don't trust your life to IBM PC?
I'll tell you what. My favorite part about that is I like to imagine that it's paid for by a group of pedicab drivers who really just want to unload weed. It's like, don't get in an Uber. Get in my pedicab. I'm trying to sell this weed I bought. I'm just sitting on it.
Yeah, here, do a Google News search for taxi rapist.
Oh, yeah, dude. Well, as a matter of fact, and that was the response, of course. If you look at the, let's see, on all these comments, they instantly... You start scrolling down, and it's links to all of these rapists or all of criminal history. Yellow cab driver arrested for sexual assault. I mean, it's like, yeah, it's. But again, the demonization of you know the other is we're entering a period where soon that other will be an unfathomable technology.
Well, I mean, understand the context here too is that those taxi cab companies are dying. They are being killed by Uber, and this is a very, very desperate measure because, you know, they've had these nice protections for a very long time and had a good thing going, and that's coming to an end, and there ain't no real bright and shiny future for them. And, you know, this is, you know, in the frustrating part, you're like, yeah, this is a business that, like, in some places still doesn't take credit cards, you know, and because they want to do cash only. Well, and why?
And that's the funny part. Here's what Uber reminds me of. It reminds me of Netflix, because Netflix, early on, they began with the ending in mind. Netflix did not launch itself calling itself DVDs by mail. They called themselves Netflix.
Streamflix.
because they wanted to eventually deliver internet or video over the internet, right? And so, you know, that's where Uber's at, is Uber does not want to be in the, you know, self-owned car cabbie business. They want to be in the car, you know, self-driving cars that get you from point A to point B in as efficient a price-controlled manner as possible.
Yeah, they want to be transportation. They look at whatever moving bits or moving bodies from point A to point B. And you know, there's an article that came out this week. Carnegie Mellon, which has one of the biggest pioneering robotics divisions in the world, lost about a third of its staff recently to Uber, because Uber built a facility right across the street and been hiring them left and right. And they've now got an agreement with Carnegie Mellon, like, you know, technology development. But for some of the people in Carnegie who didn't get hired, you know, whatever, it's like, we just lost a third of our department to go work for Uber to develop robot driving cars.
That's so amazing.
Yeah, that's
and that's where the big news story this week was in Pittsburgh, the Uber car driving around, which is very, very interesting to kind of see that you know, far more urban kind of setting.
Yeah, so the question is, what do people do with their time once they don't have to do we've talked about it before, but there's that Wired article that said, here's why a robot's going to replace your job. These are the five stages you go through. Is a robot can never do my job. And then you go through, well, the robot could do that part of my job, but I'm glad because now I'm doing this other part that doesn't involve robots. And then, you know, and it's this thing. But in a world where, you know, drivers or change makers or cashiers? I mean, does anyone love being a cashier? What would we do if none of us had to be cashiers?
Look to cities with really high unemployment and ask those people what they're doing. Look at places where they raise minimum wage and they effectively price people out of getting a job there, or, you know, starting, you know, places where teenagers can't get jobs anymore because it's, you know, newsflash, hiring teenagers isn't always worth it.
I mean, to be honest, I think we're headed to a place, get this, try this on for size. If the trends keep going, let's say we reach a point where we don't have to worry about feeding ourselves. Food's pretty much free. Robots do all the work for that. We don't have to worry about moving ourselves around. Robots handle all of that stuff. We don't have to worry about any transactional things because robots handle all that stuff. I think we enter a world. It's like
we're all competitive Hearthstone players.
Well, you joke, but I think we enter a world. I think our destiny is to pretty much our contribution to society is to entertain each other. It's a Patreon, a Patreon.com world.
But let me ask you something though, Brian. Look at San Francisco. Look at the debates going on there, where you have people who have a skill set that is marginally useful within an economy that may be more artisan based or whatever. And then you have people in the tech industry who are very, very highly compensated, who are extremely wealthy, who then decide, I don't just need this apartment, I want all five apartments around me so I can build my own house. And you have people who are extremely wealthy that are taking over. You get this extreme polarity, extreme polarization of wealth. And on one level, you know, the people there at the bottom aren't complaining that they can't eat. They're kind of complaining that they can't live there anymore. And understand, arch capitalist here talking here, you know, yeah. Okay. But for those people in that experience, it's not fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
and really it's like, I have heard not rich people, like just people who have enough money to buy a house, which in California is a lot, but like, these are friends of mine, friends of ours, right? Who have had the conversations of like, okay, if I buy this house, how do I get the people out of it? You know, like, and not in a mean kind of way, but in a like, hey, the only way that this house makes sense for me is if I can rent it out, and I can't rent it out at these rent controlled prices. Like it is a mess and a half.
Yeah, I don't know what the answer is, but I think about it a lot, about where we're headed, about like, what is mankind's role in a world where we're nipping at the heels, like in the next 20 years, the one place that you could rely on humans to be number one at is, you know, idea generation of creative insights of, you know, predicting and making a claim and having these explosive scientific breakthroughs. Algorithms coming down the pipe for that too. And it's like I don't know, what is the ultimate role of humanity in general?
I think that we see this now, nobody wants to call it, we focus on, you know, it's like we get upset over, and rightfully so, over racial tensions, but some of that's really based on economics. You know, it's based upon our perceptions of people who aren't at our economic level, and it's weird because you look at intelligence factors and you look at people who are highly skilled or highly intelligent who then are now dominating parts of the economy. And what how do you equalize that from, you know, somebody who has a 95 IQ versus somebody who has 120 IQ? I can demonstrably, you look at the data, that 120 IQ person is going to be making $20,000-$30,000 more than that other person. You know, generally I'm making stuff up here, folks, but generally speaking, that's true.
Sure.
And how do you address that? And you know, my position is that I don't think that's a role of government to try to address.
Well, this is the weird part. This is where my hardcore libertarian streak sort of breaks down, is because I don't see how we necessarily get to a place of reduced. And I don't even know if our goal needs to be that we. So the question is like, you know, are we on track for massive polarizations between the haves and the have-nots? And I think we all agree that if that's what we're on track for, that's not a really great place to be. But I am not smart enough to think of a non-governmental way to keep that from happening. And I understand why people want to use government to keep it to happen. And I don't know.
Well, I think the question is always like, with the haves and the have-nots, it's always like, well, if the have-nots can feed themselves and have like shelter, you know, like if we continue to raise the floor and the ultra rich can buy planets, like, I don't know. Like, I don't know. I don't know how, I mean, like, you know, I'm more concerned about everybody at the bottom kind of coming up than I am with how far the top is away from it.
We're definitely headed to that, but we are about to enter the God cheat code on the video game of humanity. Like, we're about to have unlimited health, unlimited ammo, and be able to fight anything. And many games suddenly don't make sense once you do that. Some games make more sense once you do that. Minecraft is kind of dumb as a, you know, protect yourself against the creepers game. Kind of rad once you unlock the cheat code and can build anything you want and do whatever you want, you know?
Yeah, I think, but you look at the riots and the things we've been dealing with lately. They're not food riots. They're not riots like, you know, in, you know, Soylent Green. These are riots from people who feel like they're not being fairly represented. These are riots from people who feel like they've been marginalized, that the power exists outside of their neighborhoods, that the wealthy and everybody else has this. Correct or incorrect? That is the perception, and I think there's a lot of reality to that. That doesn't in these scenarios where, hey, that doesn't go away, you know, it only increases the perception of, you know, of that. And I think that's the concern, is that, you know, when we talk about, like, you know, when libertarians are talking about redistribution of wealth, the problem we get into is that all the other systems for redistribution are horribly flawed and tend to condense and consolidate the power in redistribution into the bureaucrats, into that group there, and you're just creating another group of, you know, one percenters or whatever like that, you know. But I have something I want to show you.
All right.
I'm going to send this link to you here, and we talk about, you know, where we're going with the creative arts. Are you familiar with, you know, remember Watson?
Oh, sure, Fremp. The Jeopardy champion that's currently going to med school and hopes to be a doctor right now.
Do you know what else Watson's doing?
What else?
Because Watson is actually very multi-talented. Watson is a chef.
Oh, that's right. I did hear about this. Yeah.
So Watson, the supercomputer, you can, you know, put all sorts of data into it, and Watson will figure things out. Well, the latest thing is, if you go to IBMChefWatson.com, you can sign up and sign up for a program. Basically, what it does is you tell Watson, these are the ingredients I have. You know, I have some cod, I have some beef jerky, I have, you know, some tortillas and some peaches. And Watson's a male name. We'll use that. I don't want to be too gender specific here. Watson will figure out.
I believe linguistically, this is the movement, is anytime gender is in specific, that we use the word they. I think that's what you say is they. Because we live in a world where people identify.
All right. I'm sick of you politically correct weasels. Let's just call it what it is. God, I'm ready to submit to it.
Well, I think because Watson from Sherlock Holmes, Watson was that, and I wrestle with this all the time, is trying to, you know, when I'm writing, like, did I just make a room full of male characters because I'm a dude? Like, go back and think that through, you know.
Yeah, come on, man.
I'm gonna have every woman make some reference to how, you know, attractive Thor is.
Calm down, Joss.
If I remember what I read about this correctly, it's come up with a number of novel, heretofore undiscovered combinations of flavors that are pretty good.
Yeah. So there's a person who's had some experience doing some chef stuff. He talks about Matt O'Leary writing for it was an article on Medium. I don't know if that's where it originally came from, but anyhow, O'Leary decided to give it a shot, and some of the recipes were just way out there, but some of them, you know, and were not the best, you know, like, we're okay. And then he describes, for instance, Watson says, diner cod pizza.
Of course.
Okay. You know, three words you don't expect to see together. And he describes it as how, like, if Dawn of the Dead had a different name, like Zombies Go Shopping, it would have been beloved, but because the name was so weird, it was hard for people to accept.
Right. Yeah.
And he says that's the same thing with this, but he describes it as, it's not a pizza, doesn't have anything to do with it, but there's it uses, like, cod, radishes, ginger, olives, prepares it. Now, sometimes Watson doesn't quite know
what degree to put the ingredient. I mean, how much of the ingredients go in, et cetera, like this. So you kind of need to be a chef to figure some of these things out.
Here's the money quote. He says, "To be clear, I fully expected to throw this meal away. I had the website for curry delivery already open on my phone. That's all before I ate two of the pizzas. They taste like nothing on earth. The addition of Comté cheese, is that what that is? And chives is the sort of genius slash absurdity that makes people into millionaires. I was, however, nervous to give one to my pregnant fiance." That's amazing.
Dude, that's insane. And I love that these things just kind of dot our life, you know, that, you know, even as wonky and weird as like Microsoft's Guess Your Age tool or something like that, just the forward facing application of massive computational power is so interesting to me. And I kind of feel like we are at such the goofy infancy of it that, you know, it's going to collapse on us like an amazing wave.
I just like the fact that we're already trusting supercomputers to feed us. Like, here, try this. Make this in the kitchen. Go ahead, try it, guys. Try it. You're not going to try to murder us, are you, Watson? No. Eat it. It's good. It's good. Have I ever done you wrong? No. All right, then eat it. Eat it. Yeah.
I'm not familiar with it, so you guys might know. Is it taking in nutritional like concepts like that you should eat a certain way, or
there has to be
some human programming to it, right?
I believe, if you know, from what I've heard, and again, I'm not refreshed on this, but I believe it's just for combining and processes to create a tasty experience given a limited set of starting.
But what
points.
Is tasty is, I guess, that's the,
well, again, that's here's the funny part,
the tricky goal.
Watson doesn't have to know what tasty is. He just has to know that these things and these processes correlate highly with satisfaction among humans. That's all it has to know, and then come up with some theories.
And he can make substitutions in there. He might look and say, you know, celery salt might work well instead of this other thing. Like, you know, like, you want to substitute something for meat? Well, mushrooms might work for this or that. So you can make these different substitutions from there and come up with things that are, you know, ideally designed to, you know, and that's the amazing thing here is that, you know, they talk about the fact that this is something that you would never have thought would taste good. And then, holy cow, it tastes good.
So I feel like, we're headed to, I mean, we certainly right now, I mean, it's not even we're headed towards right now. We are in a symbiotic relationship with technology. We perceive ourselves as being the dominant life form that is benefiting from a little bit of this, you know, parasitic, you know, technology requires us to turn it on, provide power, do all these things. We don't mind dedicating those efforts to it. How long until you think that's flipped? Until all of a sudden we're the unnecessary appendage to the surviving of artificially intelligent technology. But now I believe we'll still be an important part of it. I don't think we're ever going to. I think we are married to technology and we will always be part of it and it will always be part of us. But at some point, you know, one of us can fire the other, even though we won't. Like we would never. Right now we're on top and we could fire technology.
Well,
but we wouldn't.
I have a friend, his father worked for IBM. And by the way, if you go to IBM Chef Watson, you can sign up in like 2 seconds and be using this thing right away. And I promise you the supercomputer won't poison you. I have a friend, his father worked for IBM. Had worked there for 30 years. Then one day they said, all right, we don't need you anymore. His father repaired typewriters for IBM. He was fixed the mechanical typewriters. And then, obviously, at some point, we're not really using those so much anymore here,
sure.
You know. And this is all he knew. That was his entire thing. And so an entire category of technology made his job irrelevant, and it was a job that was never going to come back. And we see that already, I guess, is what we're saying. We're already seeing computers and technology eliminate certain, you know, if you don't have another set of skills that you can go to, then, yeah, I mean, it's Foxconn is, you know, we complain about the labor situation in Foxconn, and rightfully so, as compassionate human beings. Foxconn is as quickly as they can getting rid of all the human jobs they're able to with robots.
Yeah.
And some of us, you know, we're we're already, you know, we're already there going, well, I don't fit in here.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose my advice to all of us, and weirdly, including to ourselves, like, let's face it, what we're doing right now is we're offering the service of punditry. We're offering the service of discovery of unusual, interesting stories.
Watch us dance.
We're offering insights and predictions about what might be. I mean, what, 10 years, 15 years? Somebody will have an algorithm that can virtualize all this for us?
Which is why we're creating a new Patreon. It's a podcast just for robots.
Wait a minute. We haven't mentioned the old Patreon. Let's pimp the old place before we get to promoting the new one.
No, but seriously, patreon.com/bleep bloop bloop bleep blop bloop bleep will delight you and your robot pal.
Or patreon.com/weirdthings. We are closing in on 500 patrons. Join the army. Oh, we still haven't decided what the name of our army is. What do we call our people? Our secret squadron.
If only some really brilliant, smart people had made suggestions for...
All right, let's do this. All right, we've got Black Squadron, the Weird Things Platoon, Agents of Weird,
ooh,
Things League, the Weird League, Weird Squadron, I like WTF, the Weird Task Force. Paranormal Military Syndicate, or PMS for short. Thank you, Matthew. The Mystic Protectorate, the Guild of Preternatural Deference, the Thaumaturgic Inquisition, like Mensa but with wizards, and the Federal Investigative Security Team, or FIST for short. What do you guys think?
I think Agents of Weird... or like Mensa, but with wizards, are my two favorite.
I got to admit, I like WTF, the Weird Task Force. You can join the WTF. Or Agents of Weird, I could be talked into. Or the Weird League. I like the word league. Or WTP, the Weird Things Platoon, following the Weird Things podcast.
Mm. Andrew, what do you like?
You know, the one that just popped out at me was Agents of Weird. That just jumped at me. And I think that, and not to say that we can't have divisions within of this, of other
good
things.
Good point.
You know, because, listen, you know, we might want to have, you know, the Thaumaturgic Inquisition within, you know, as we go out there and inquire about thaumaturgy. You
want to know what, Andrew? I think you're on to something here. So everybody, I feel like if we can all agree on Agents of Weird, that's a good blanket, right?
All right.
You know, like we are all Agents of Weird. And when you write in, feel free to fill in your own subsection so we can identify you in our hierarchy.
Ooh, that's good. Are you part of the Weird Task Force? Are you WTF subsection 3? Or are you part of the Guild of Preternatural Defense?
And as we know... these weird and arcane subsections, which are isolated from each other, can never come back and bite you.
No. They're all, we like to say that it's as a hygiene issue, we want to keep each person in their individual cells. We just, you know, like distributed cells so that no one agent of weird can rat out the other ones.
Sure.
Done and done. Those are some great suggestions.
Yasser. Yasser gave us
Agents of Weird. Do you want to go into picks?
I say we go to picks. We're already creeping up on 50 minutes here.
All right, because I got something so awesome, though.
You want to dive in, or you want to save it for next week?
I'll save it for next week.
Okay. He says begrudgingly.
Oh, God. Yeah, no, it's better for next week. Gentlemen.
Yo.
What are our picks?
I got a pick. I mean, it's kind of like a pre-pick because I really haven't had a whole lot of time about it. But it's finally arrived. My Apple Watch.
Oh,
Is now around my wrist.
By the way, I knew the moment it said you have an incoming drawing from Joseph Robert Young. Knowing full well what it was going to be. I enjoyed the delicate depiction of male genitalia on my wrist, thanks to Justin.
Listen, man, living the dream. I'm very, very excited about it. So, you know, immediate 24-hour thoughts. I don't know if I have any original kind of thoughts, but I do hammer in the idea that It is probably the steepest learning curve I've ever had for a Apple device. It was something that I, for the first time ever, I had to watch the videos to understand what the hell was going on. You know, the UI is very, very interesting. I do like it a lot. It has yet to kind of hit me with that transfixing spell that I think the iPod and the iPad and the iPhone all kind of like had within a few days. Maybe it'll hit me at some point. I suspect that will be more it me finding just the app that is amazing for it, you know, because it certainly seems like a great platform for that. But I'm actually enjoying it a lot. I think it's a real fun. I mean, maybe I was just living in a world where I wanted a smartwatch and I didn't realize it. And now I have a smartwatch and I like it. So I can't compare it to like the Pebble or a Google Wear or an Android Wear watch. Maybe I would like that as much as I like the Apple Watch. But I'm having a real good time with it. I think it's super rad.
My only real want to grab Apple by the lapel and shake them is, I mean, could
good there, thing they wear turtlenecks.
Yeah, that's right.
gotcha, said Tim Cook as he jumped into his Zeppelin.
I just really, really wish it would get straight to the point with an alert instead of showing me like, you know, when somebody sends a tweet and I get a text message for it, I feel my wrist vibrate. And then and again, I have a job. It won't display it on its own. I have to lift up my hand and look. And then it doesn't display the message. It displays the text icon and the word Twitter underneath. And I'm like, yes, okay, great. It's a tweet. And then it, you know, again, it's up to me to do things. I just wish it would just, you know, feed me, like, let me do less to get more.
So, I don't know. Like, I've definitely, like, and you know, and this is really, it is on the device, but it took me maybe, you know, two or three times of just fiddling with different notifications and figuring out like, oh God, no, like things that I probably should have figured out before, but I just didn't care about, like having Facebook automatically put stuff on my calendar that would show up in one of my like prominent text alerts. It's like I had to bring that out of my calendar, just to kind of get the ecosystem a little bit harmonious for it. So it's taken me two or three little dials to switch, to do that. And I suspect that, you know, that is not, that's not ideal. You know, you just want it to kind of work exactly as you want it to work. And this,
well, and this is why I'm convinced, you know, it was John Tilton that pointed out that, you know, all of these things were met. Any problem or missing of the, you know, center of the target were magnified times 1,000 with the Pebble smartwatch when it first launched. Like full on giant chunks of it just didn't work and were broken. And amazingly, you know, as they refined everything, it just works better and better and better. And I'm looking very much forward to that from the Apple Watch over the next year.
I will say this, that for your complaint, I guess what's interesting about the product is that it is super personal, and I enjoy the fact that it taps me on the shoulder or taps me on the wrist, and you know, I understand that it's not just a big block of text, you know, between whether or not the Pirates have beat the Mets or you're texting me or you know, there's a Twitter alert that somebody retweeted something that I did. I like that graphical moment before I see what the news is.
Here's what I don't like about it is that socially, the Apple Watch does extremely well when you're in this position, when you are facing the watch and have a finger over it, and it's clear to everyone around you that you are paying attention to the watch and nothing else. Whereas me socially, what I value most about the watch is the ability to not look like I'm that asshole pulling out my phone and checking an alert or whatever. Instead, to in the micro moment of a casual glance, know, okay, that vibration, this alert, it's not really worth stopping this conversation or whatever. And the Apple Watch does not play nice with that. It wants your full attention or not at all. And
well, but I guess that's where the notifications for me come in. And it's like what I'm realizing is like there is a difference between what I want on my wrist and what I want on my phone and what's something that like I want to store up, like Instagram likes. Don't need it on my wrist. Right.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, figuring out a better way to figure out what Twitter stuff I want. If I want it there at all, maybe I don't, you know, and that's some.
an interesting test of things is how you use it when you're not paying attention. You know, the you know, I think of like here I've responded to two messages while this conversation's gone on my watch. And anybody watch me, it's obvious as I, you know, direct my attention now that I'm probably doing it. But it's a much different experience than pulling out my phone and doing that. It's just like, yep, nope, da-da-da. And that's what's interesting to me. It's just the idea of like, because if you ask me, how do I use it? And it's like, yeah, I can leave the house with it. I'm okay. I feel a little bit naked without it, but I don't feel, oh, I got to go back and go get it. Like if I left my house without my iPhone, I'd be like going on the Oregon Trail without food.
If I got on an airplane without my iPhone, I'm pulling a gun and landing the plane and driving back as soon as I get bailed out.
Yeah, that's interesting, though. I think that... And I wonder if I will shift to this, but I don't perceive my wrist as a two-way communication device. Like, if I want to say something back, then my phone's out in my hand. I pretty much only want it as a one-way thing, so I can know that in my pocket is a few to-dos that I could do, you know, when it's appropriate to get around the corner, I can respond to this tweet and that tweet and say something back to Justin on text or XYZ. Like, at that point, I'm responding, then my phone is out and I'm doing it right. I'm not going to... onesie twosie on my wrist.
I found it to be a great text back thing. Like it's been that's probably the biggest place where I've found myself kind of personally reacting to it is just having, especially since, you know, it's made me go in and input my own set, you know, canned responses and stuff like that. So like I can respond with stuff that's a little bit more personal than what they have.
In this entire conversation, I just made, you know, somebody asked me, do I have any plans for my birthday tomorrow? The answer was no. Like, oh, do you want to get it later in the week? Yes. They said, how about Thursday? I said, yes. All through watch, you know, and not trying to prove a point though, but that's what I love.
But I guess really what's interesting to me, Brian, is that like the watch is, I mean, like they made a point to say this is the most personal device we've ever released. And I think that the double-edged sword of that is that personalities are so varied. Personalities toward technologies are so varied that this isn't like, you know, when the iPhone came out, there were things that nobody was like, oh my God, I love all the apps that go preloaded on my phone. And like, oh my God, I really love the fact that like I can't use the full internet. Like there were nobody was doing that. So solving those were kind of universal. The personality elements of it weren't all that controversial. With the watch, people like watches for different things. People have different, you know, personalities on what they want. You know, like I want to be able to respond to something and I like having that freedom. You want more of a an efficient and exciting notification
machine. Here's why is if I'm in a social situation where I would be horrified to be seen texting, then I'm also going to be horrified to be seen poking and paying full attention and touching my watch. And so, as a result, to me, the wristwatch smart device, its role is to quietly feed me information so that I can at least know what's waiting in my pocket, so I can go excuse myself to have a conversation or whatever. And I do not get that with the Apple Watch. And so, again, that attitude may change, but for right now, I would be legit horrified, you know, at Penny's recital to be seen doing this, scrolling up and down, looking through my tweets. However, I would not at all mind, you know, just glancing down like, oh, Twitter's blowing up over something.
I think you just illustrated the different, you know, the different sort of thing. Like, yeah, I found myself in a couple boring situations lately where I'm tempted to like go to the watch and read the mail. But for me here, it's, you know, it's a quicker, expedient way to like respond to text messages without pulling out my phone. And not in a... I didn't like was disingenuous to me about like the, you know, Google Glass was like, oh, you know, what's sincere about this? You know, when instead you can have this thing that they can't see you. It's like, no, that's yeah. You're still that's not being honest. Where for me, it's instead of like, hold on a second. Got it. It's be like, oh. Anyhow, you know, it's a...
Yeah, see, I don't see much of a difference between the two of those.
It's
yeah.
a time thing. I mean, I guess yeah. the thing is that it's more of a, I'm spending less time getting to that thing to respond, and I can just quickly get out if I'm going to choose to respond.
Well, hang on, I accidentally clicked the wrong button.
I think, you know, sorry, for me, the big difference is that I can't get lost in my watch in a way that I do get lost with my phone.
Like, if I pull out my phone, then it is highly unlikely that I am doing one thing and putting it right back. Like, if I answer a text message, I'm probably going to check Twitter. If I check Twitter, I'm probably going to check my email. If I check my email, I'm probably going to play 45 minutes of Hearthstone. You know, there's an element to just like, oh, boop, boop, and we're done. Like, yeah. And it might not be in social situations also. You know, I think that, like, certainly what you want, and ultimately what you want it, for it to be in social situations, you might not want it to be when you're on a walk or on a run.
Well,
or if you're just by yourself
doing this,
or you're traveling and there's a lot of alone time.
This is why I have high hopes, is because, you know, who's to say a year from now, the watch won't have a better idea of when you're busy doing something and then enter a mode where it only interrupts if it knows it's going to be important. You know, it could, they're going to have incredible amounts of data about when people bother to respond or not. And they're all like, hey, you know what we figured out is when people are working out, they seem to never respond to anything unless it's a personal text from another person. So why don't we never bother them with tweets or Instagram or Facebook stuff? You know, there's going to be these algorithms that they're going to figure out to, you know, where you won't have to on purpose decide when you do and don't want to be interrupted.
You want to know what, though? I almost feel like that will create more frustration in that, like, again, what we can agree is that it's a bright screen. You know, and that I feel like in terms of personal preference is pretty much where it ends. And that is the problem just with this class of device, is that what we want from it is different. And to build that, I don't think that there is a one size fits all algorithm. I think that there might be things that are smarter to start you off that get you closer. But I think you're always going to be nipping and tucking and twisting and turning certain dials. And maybe that means that this class of device, what I have on my wrist right now, is just not going to survive. Or maybe it means that it gets smarter and we get better at turning, you know, levers and dials.
Yeah, I can't see. I mean, first of all, you are right. I think there is a place for humans to adjust their behavior to the technology that's available to them. But I suspect that the more forward-thinking companies, and I put Apple at the high top of that list, will figure out ways to let the technology adapt to the human. And you know, there's no reason that, you know, right now we're talking about the difference between, you know, Pebble's attitude towards what its role is versus Apple's attitude. You know, I don't know. Eventually it won't matter because they'll all have figured out, you know, how to adjust and best serve, you know, the humans wearing them.
So moving on, Brian, do you have a pick?
Yeah, I finished up. I talked about Rise of the Warrior Cop, Radley Balko's book. I'm really, really glad that I read it. Man, did it really bum me out. Man, did it really depress me, because it's Thomas Jefferson's quote, is the natural tendency is for, you know, government to grow and for liberty to fall back. And it's not just an indictment of the drug war, although that's a big part of it. It's not just an indictment of the offloading of military equipment to local police departments. It's also an indictment of the kind of person that police forces are attracting nowadays. You know, they're not looking for friendly, problem-solving, community-minded individuals for whom violence is a last resort. They are actively pitching, you like video games, you like kicking in doors and taking down bad guys, then you join the police department. And I don't see a way out for it. It just seems like that's where we're headed. I mean, you know, he gives the token, you know, positive spin on the end, talking about, you know, that people are at least talking about winding down the rhetoric on the war on drugs. But I was left just really bummed out about it, especially because I knew of stories that have happened since the book came out. You know, one of the tragic tales was some cops had the wrong address, or you know, I don't know whether they're right or they're wrong. Somebody had pot or didn't have pot or whatever. Their technique was not to knock on the door and say, hello, we think you are selling drugs. Their technique was to shoot a flashbang that landed in the crib of a 2.5-year-old child. And as the parent of a 2.5-year-old child, you know, it just breaks my heart. It's rough. I think it's important that everyone should know it. I think you should read it. It will not be fun, but I think it's a good service that this book was written.
as a critical thinker, let me ask you this. What is the data? What does the data say as far as increases in these sorts of things?
Well, and this is all you know, the case that's made very well by Radley Balco is you know, the data is that we're seeing an increase we are seeing a massive increase in the proliferation of paramilitary tactics among police forces, and a side effect of that is that we are seeing an increase. You know, people, if you spend $250,000 for a tank like device that can drive into a car, a house, then you tend to use it. And what we're seeing is a massive increase of wrong door knocks. We're seeing a massive increase of no-knock raids, which are largely unnecessary. And we're seeing ugly amounts of collateral damage along the way, I would say, would be the most scientifically accurate way to lay it out.
Interesting.
And it's unfortunate. And again, this is kind of like I don't know how to fix it. I don't know how to stop it. It's the incentives are for we got a lot of equipment I think when we talked about it last week, we talked about the whole reason America was resistant to a standing military at all, and you know how polices were always, you know, essentially constables and sheriffs handling mostly communities. Handled things themselves. They would afford, here and there form a posse, both for just and unjust reasons. I don't know what the answer is. I'm left really confused and upset by it. But again, Radley Balco's Rise of the Warrior Cop is a fascinating, if slightly depressing, assessment of where things are headed.
I mean, I guess the one thing that just in hearing it, and again, I haven't read it, that kind of makes me sort of is the idea of assigning, you know, personality, like rise of personality, you know, kind of stuff. I'd be very curious to hear what, you know, longtime career cops would say about new trainees or new people that come in and stuff like that.
It's interesting because what happens is you set an expectation. For example, the guy who was in charge of the police force during the WTO defended his use of smoke grenades and of military style tactics at the time until, you know, all the way through when he wrote his autobiography. And then he finds himself at a book signing event and looking eye to eye with some guy who was there. He was like, I got blasted in the face with this. This is, you set up this whole thing. You set up the expectation. You called in too many forces. You set up a line, and then you built up this confrontation. And then when you fired smoke grenades, you fired them past the line, giving us only one direction to go, to run into this line of people who are already outfitted in riot gear. You know, it's like you could have had them in buses around the corner ready if something were, you know, if necessary. But instead, you created this social situation and it deeply affected the guy. And he later said it was the worst mistake I ever made. And he found himself at a later event saying that meeting this one person changed everything. And that person was in the audience for that follow-up event. It's not easy and it's not simple and it's not black and white. And I think the book does an incredible job of explaining how complicated things are, but there's also little to no doubt that we are in a place that is very different from where we were 40 years ago as far as the expected role of police, you know. And it's like, if you spend a lot of money, you know, nobody wants to vote against the police. Everyone supports law enforcement. But the way we do it is we want to spend money. It was like, well, what are we going to spend that money on? Well, better equipment. Where are we going to get better equipment? We're going to get it from the military. And then and as a result, our police look more and more like a standing army living in the city. And what does a standing army do? A standing army exists to knock things over and to take down bad guys. And what do you do if nobody happens to be a bad guy at the moment? Well, unfortunately, we've had a, you know, 30, 40 year history with the war on drugs. So we take, you know, somebody who's peddling, you know, a few joints over here and treat them like we just took down Darth Vader, you know. And that's there are no answers in there. There's just a quiet indictment of how we're doing it so far. I don't know. I take that back. He does give some programs that seem to work better and create less violence.
It was a slap in the face for me, man. It was a wake up call that was very difficult to read.
Well, my pick is a self serving one, but it's a free one, folks.
Oh yeah!
If you go to Amazon or Barnes and Noble or Kobo or one of those other online retailers of ebooks, you'll find, if you type in "Fire in the Sky" by Andrew Main, you will see a free as in free, Jessica Blackwood short story that takes place between Name of the Devil. Got to put Andrew Main in there too.
Name
of the Devil, the new one coming out, and Angel Killer. This is a little story, a little adventure that happened between those two events. It's totally free right now. And if you read it and you like it, you could give me a review if you like it. If you love it, give it a review. If you didn't, then just
now,
go ahead.
Hold on, Andrew. Why would a self-serving, profit-minded, libertarian author give away something for free?
Because I'm a good person.
Oh, okay.
some people might read into some sort of intention that the goal is to get people who have maybe, you know, to reward people who have read the other book, give them a little free little surprise, or perhaps to get people who have, a little sitting on the fence there, kind of curious about this character.
Hey, look at this. First review is my buddy CJ Johnson, who became a genuine organic fan ever since he read Public Enemy Zero. Yeah, that he's fallen in love with your stuff. That's awesome.
So there you go. It's free, folks. Go ahead.
And by the way, this does lead up to Name of the Devil, which when does that hit?
July 7th. Name of the Devil.
And you got plenty of time to not only read Angel Killer, also Fire in the Sky. Get yourself ready for Name of the Devil, which is awesome. And everybody should go ahead and check it out. Man, I did my part. I went to Powell's Books yesterday, bought Angel Killer, gave it to a stranger. And I suggest everybody do that as well. Go ahead, buy it, read it, pass it along. We're proselytizing here for the Church of Maine.
Actually, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with not even hiding that that we're doing anything otherwise. It's a fantastic book that I loved it. I loved it, and I can't wait for the next one.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Fire in the Sky. I'm pumped to read it.
All right, kids. Here's my thought. For After Things,
yeah,
we talk about how to survive the future run by robots.
That's a great idea. Especially because, again, After Things is where we talk about all things, you know, the development of the artistic entrepreneur. And I think that that's a real thing that we got to talk about. How's it been?
It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.